Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Southern Arizona's Sky Islands attract bird watchers from around the world, but those delicate habitats are in danger. And we meet a scientist who is working to change your memories. But first, President Trump is coming back to the Valley this month. He'll headline a Build the Red Wall rally hosted by Turning Point USA at Dream City Church in Phoenix on April 17th. Entrance to the event will be first come, first serve, like a lot of political events like this. But everyone who signs up has to check their voter registration status to get in. It appears this is part of a larger effort to collect voter data ahead of the midterm elections. And it's being run by a nonprofit headed up by a longtime Turning Point employee, who also happens to be the wife of a former state lawmaker who has been accused of fraud. Our own KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk broke this story, and he joins me in studio now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so that was a complicated web that I just outlined there. So let me have you walk us through this, Wayne. When did you notice there was something a little different about signups for this event that the president's coming to?
Well, we were getting ready to do the kind of typical story everyone else is doing, just notifying our audience that, you know, that the president is coming to town. And then our political editor, Ben Giles, actually was looking at this landing page, and there were a few red flags. And one of them was that what you mentioned, no tickets, but you have to like check your voter registration. There was a little form to help you do that, name, address, all that good stuff. But it also asks you some questions like, do you plan to vote? Is it your first time you voted? How do you plan to vote this time? And little drop down menus for those. And then it all linked to a form created by a separate organization called Vote Online, something we hadn't really ever heard of before.
Right. Okay. So you tracked down that company a little bit, tried to figure out who runs it, where they're located, things like that. What'd you find?
Yeah. So we went to their website, and it looked kind of like a lot of these other kind of voter education groups you see out there, well-known ones, League of Women Voters, Vote.org, you know, bright purple and green colors with a bunch of different states you can click on where you live, and it has your information and how to register to vote and all these other things that you might have questions about.
Sure.
But then there was some other interesting information. If you clicked on their privacy terms and scrolled down and found their address, it's the same address as Turning Point USA here in Phoenix.
Huh.
And then as I did a little bit more digging, found some other connections to Turning Point. So they are a 501c3 nonprofit, like a lot of those other voter education groups, but it appears, you know, they're very connected to this group that is deeply involved in Republican politics.
Who's running it?
So that would be Amy Smith. I immediately reached out to Turning Point and Vote Online and tried to get some information about how they were connected. Didn't hear back, so went online and was digging through LinkedIn, social media, that kind of thing, and found Amy Smith is the CEO. She is decade-long Turning Point USA / Turning Point Action political arm employee, but also married to Austin Smith, as you mentioned, former state lawmaker who pled guilty to multiple counts related to forging voter signatures when he was seeking re-election, ended up leaving the legislature, dropping that re-election bid. So interesting to us that this person who was committed voter fraud, essentially, now is married to a person who's collecting all this voter information.
So Austin Smith had left his job at Turning Point at the time when he pleaded guilty back in, I think it was 2024. Where is he now?
That's unclear. We had reported a few months later that it looked like, or about like at least by the next year, 2025, it looked like he returned to Turning Point. You know, again, LinkedIn, wealth of information. Again, he listed it as his employer. He was still on the website, all that good stuff. Now I did a little digging. It looks like he might own a landscaping company now. So not sure if he's still involved with Turning Point, but his wife is, you know, definitely listing herself as the CEO of this new voter registration effort that's closely tied to the organization.
So, Wayne, tell us more about this data that they're collecting from voters and at these events. Like, what are they asking for? What might they use it for?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, a lot of the typical information, name, address, all that good stuff, and then kind of trying to figure out whether you voted before, whether you're high, you know, what we call a high propensity voter, someone who turns out to every election, or low propensity voter. This is your first time. You're really engaged by the president coming into town, but you never make it out to the ballot. And then how you're going to vote by mail, in person, all that kind of stuff. And all of this information, they're not the only one that does this. A lot of political groups gather this type of information. They're building a profile of you. You know, I think they figure that if you're interested in attending an event with the president, then you're probably the type of voter they like that's going to support the candidates that they like. And so now they want to figure out how are we going to make sure you get to the polls. So all this information they can gather, they can combine with information from other sources, publicly available voter data that shows, you know, the past elections you voted in, and kind of build a profile and the best way to engage you. So, you know, maybe you say you never voted before, but you do want to come see the president. So now they're going to figure out what type of messaging can we send to that kind of voter to get into the polls. Or you vote a lot. And now we know your address. So we know the district you're in. So now we can send you very specific stuff about the elections in your area to try and get you out. And, you know, Turning Point maybe can't do this on their own, but they can work with all these, this I call it the Turning Point expanded universe of organizations that they're building out to try and target these voters.
You mentioned this is a 501c3 nonprofit, right? Are they allowed to participate in political activity?
No. So C3s can't directly participate in political activity. But again, as I mentioned, they have all of these other organizations. So there's Turning Point Action, which is a C4, a bit of a different type of nonprofit, which can engage in some political activity. And there's nothing stopping Vote Online from sharing this information with those other groups. So they could give the information they gather over to Turning Point Action. They can use it to target some stuff. And then Vote Online itself is a voter education nonprofit. So they can't go out and say like, hey, vote for this person. But, you know, if you mark that you're a vote by mail person and you're the type of voter that they want to engage, they can remind you, hey, your ballot's coming. Or, hey, hey, you've gotten your ballot, make sure you turn it in, that kind of stuff. So it's not direct political activity, but once you have this profile of a voter that's going to act the way you think you want them to act, now you can encourage them to make sure they get that ballot in.
Interesting. Is it clear, Wayne, that this Vote Online group is part of a Republican voter engagement effort or linked to Turning Point in any way?
I mean, I think it's – I personally believe it's clear. Again, the exact address listed on the website is Turning Point's headquarters here in Phoenix, which is a gated building here in like South Phoenix, Ahwatukee area. And, you know, I drove by. There is no Vote Online signage anywhere on the building, but Turning Point, Turning Point, Turning Point everywhere. Mm. And again, the CEO, not only the CEO, Amy Smith, but I found a half dozen other employees who had worked for years and years and years for either Turning Point USA, Turning Point Action, or both, who are now involved in the Vote Online effort. So
would it be
either
clear to someone else, though?
No. If you go on the website, Vote Online, if you didn't find it via the Trump event, because Vote Online has a separate thing and they're also asking other groups to post their registration form on their own websites.
Right.
Yeah, there's no signage on that site at all that it's connected to Turning Point or Republican politics or anything like that.
Okay. Interesting stuff. All right. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk joining us. Wayne, thanks as always. Good reporting here.
Yeah, thank you.
Last summer, the Trump administration designated more than a third of Arizona's roughly 370-mile-long border with Mexico a military zone. It was the fourth so-called national defense area created along the border. And since, the Trump administration has detained hundreds of people for trespassing on military property. And according to an investigation by the Texas Tribune and ProPublica, since last April, at least 4,700 immigrants who were already charged with illegal entry into the country were also charged with this military trespassing count, but most of them were dropped or dismissed. To put it into context, I sat down with immigration law expert Angela Banks. She is vice dean and professor of law at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, and she told me the whole thing is pretty unprecedented.
This is pretty a new approach to thinking about immigration enforcement. And the idea is that land along the border, the president, through his executive order, ordered the government to recharacterize this land as military, military installations, which then means anybody who crosses a border without authorization is not only liable for an illegal entry charge, but they're also liable for a trespass on military installation charge.
Right. And so it added a layer of basically what prosecutors could hit someone with when they're hit with those initial charges for illegally immigrating into the country, right?
Correct.
Okay. We've seen some of these cases play out now, not necessarily here, but in other states along the border, in Texas in particular. What have they looked like? It's not been incredibly successful.
No, it hasn't. And so what's interesting is because as a criminal charge, one of the things that you have to demonstrate is mens rea, and that is the sort of intentional knowledge that the person is committing the crime that they're charged with. And interestingly, a lot of the people who are crossing had no idea that this was a military installation. Now, the government does indicate that there's signage up along the border, but they have to be able to demonstrate where the person entered and that they would have seen the sign where they entered. And so a lot of the cases that have been brought, the government hasn't been able to pinpoint where the person entered, and they also haven't been able to show that the person would have known that it was, in fact, a military installation. And the individuals who have been charged have said, I had no idea.
So why do you think the government put these military zones in place all around the border?
So, it's a curious question, and there are a couple things that I thought about. One is that when people are charged with illegal entry, they often plead guilty and are simply deported that day. Mm-hmm. With these trespass on the military installation cases, a lot of people are saying, no, I didn't do that. And so then they end up being detained while the case is waiting to go to court. And so some individuals have been detained for like 30 or 40 days. Mm. And so it could be the idea that that's just an extra deterrent. So if individuals know that they're going to have to go through these extra legal proceedings, that they won't attempt to enter. The other possibility is that because it's trespass on a military installation, it could give rise to the person being viewed as a national security risk in the future.
Interesting. Yeah.
Which could lead to additional challenges with getting a visa to enter the United States in the future.
Right. And that could have some potential impacts on migrants down the line, right? Like lots of people cross more than once. Lots of people have family in the country, want to try to come back one day legally or otherwise, right? This could restrict that for folks.
Right. Because then it could lead to additional kinds of specific reasons why someone cannot be granted a visa, inadmissibility grounds that deal with national security. And then there are fewer sort of discretionary relief options for national security reasons for not being able to enter.
Yeah. Okay. What do you make of the kind of melding of the military and immigration enforcement, which we've seen in other ways across the country as immigration raids have ramped up? It's relatively unprecedented, as we said, in this way, but in other ways as well.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is that we – you know, the question is, are we going to get to the point where members of the armed forces are going to be the ones sort of policing the border? And are they going to be deputized to sort of engage in immigration enforcement? And we haven't seen that to date, but it is something that could be on the horizon now that a lot of territory along the border is deemed a military installation.
Yeah. And that changes the ballgame a little bit. I know in Arizona, we hear every once in a while, you know, things ramp up and the governor will send National Guard troops down there, things like that. But they're not conducting immigration enforcement. They're helping out in logistic ways, usually, things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. OK. So let me turn to another story that's hit the news in recent weeks, Angela, and ask you about it since we have you here and you're an immigration expert. The city of Phoenix voted to ban ICE from city property. This is sort of in response to immigration enforcement, ICE enforcement we've seen around the country. Lots of cities, jurisdictions, counties have tried to do something to restrict maybe what happened in Minneapolis, for example, from happening in their cities. But it does raise a legal question, I think, that has already been raised by at least one Republican lawmaker here, which is that can they do that? I mean, doesn't in general immigration enforcement on the federal level trump local and state laws?
So what's really interesting is that specifically here in Arizona, there's an Arizona law that specifies that no sub-state entity can interfere with the enforcement of federal immigration enforcement. And so this puts Arizona in a particularly unique situation because whatever might be able to happen in other states, there's a real question about whether in the state of Arizona, the city of Phoenix can take any action that would impact the effectiveness of immigration enforcement. Now, what is interesting about the initiative that was passed by the city council is it doesn't say that ICE cannot. It just says that any civil law enforcement actions have to get permission from the city authorities. And so one way that this might work out is that it's possible that the city could say, well, we haven't denied anybody. And so we'll have to see how this plays out in practice.
Okay. So if it is legally challenged, they could answer in that way. Yeah. And we're talking about a pretty specific thing, right? Like on city property, not necessarily anywhere in the city.
Right. And it specifically, was talking about like staging. So when ICE is getting ready to conduct a raid, where they're getting ready, if they were using parks or city parking lots for that kind of action, or if they were trying to process people on city property, that is what would be prohibited unless they had prior permission from the city.
Very interesting. We're seeing, like I said, this happen in many cities, jurisdictions around the country who are trying to kind of preemptively do something to make people feel better, maybe who are concerned about what might happen should ICE come to their place where they live. What else could they do? Like, what other ideas have you seen local jurisdictions throw out in terms of trying to sort of buffer immigration enforcement in this way?
Well, so what's interesting is that this new sort of thinking about could you physically restrict ICE is a newer approach, because historically the approach has been just not to cooperate, not to have sort of jails cooperate and hand people over once they have finished their term in a local prison to hand them over to ICE.
And we have seen much more of that cooperation happening around the country as well, right?
Right. And so that is, you know, sort of what got cities named as sanctuary cities. And many of the actions that the administration has taken have been to target and limit the ability of those cities to take those kinds of actions.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. Angela Banks, Vice Dean and Professor of Law at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, immigration expert joining us. Angela, thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is a show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a part of southern Arizona that's bursting with life is the perfect pit stop for birds flying south for the winter. But the region could be in danger.
Really, what we're starting to see is an upset in the balance of these really, really complex systems that we call ecosystems down here.
We'll hear more about the problem and its possible solutions from a steward in the area. But first, lots of us have experienced things in our lives that we'd like to forget. Our next guest is working to make that happen, kind of. Steve Ramirez is an associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Boston University. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Mesa Arts Center as part of its National Geographic Live series at an event called Untangling the Mind. Ramirez says there are two main goals of his lab: to try to understand the biology of how we learn and how we remember, and to try to artificially activate or inactivate memories to see what that tells us about how the brain works in an effort to restore health back to the brain. Ramirez spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who asked, in layperson's terms, how one goes about trying to adjust people's memories.
Yeah, so importantly, our experimental subjects are rodents that we start off with, and they have pretty remarkably evolutionarily conserved brain areas that are involved in learning and memory that we humans also have. So the first thing we have to do is go into the brain and try to find the brain cells that hold on to one individual memory, which we've been successfully able to do. And then the second part is to go into the brain, find those brain cells, and then find a way of artificially turning them on or off to see if the animal behaves as though it's recalling a given memory, which has been also a big success story in our field in the past decade. And lastly, we think this informs what we can do in the human brain, because we have memory as well, and we know that there's physical correlates of memory in the brain. So how do we access those memories? You know, one example for me and you would just be through conversation. Like, I could ask you, how was your night yesterday? What was the last vacation you were on? And then scan your brain and see what kind of magic is happening there.
It almost sounds like, and I don't know if you've seen the movie Inside Out, but it kind of sounds like that's what you're working with, where all these memories are in like little glass balls that are just stored somewhere in our brains.
Yeah, you know, that's almost exactly how I imagined memory when I first went into the field, which was that there's somehow these biological orbs of information in the brain that hold on to our past experiences. And in a sense, that's true. It's just that those orbs are brain cells, and that within those brain cells and across brain cells and how they communicate with each other, that process can give rise to the process of memory itself. And maybe one important point here is that in Inside Out, you know, there's a scene where they go into the brain and they can pick out one of these orbs, and here's an experience of a happy memory from the past. The biggest difference with the human brain, and the rodent brain for that matter, is that any given memory is going to involve all sorts of sights and sounds and smells and emotions and context of where that memory happened. And in the brain, when you're forming that memory, there's different parts of the brain that are involved in processing the sights and sounds and smells and emotions of that experience, which is to say that memory is actually this three-dimensional web of activity that's distributed throughout the brain and not necessarily located in one single point in the brain.
So does that mean then that if you are trying to alter someone's memory or change the memory in some way, you have to A, know which aspect of the memory you're trying to deal with, be it sight, smell, voice, something like that, and then sort of know how and where to go about doing that?
Right. And we try to control that in the lab as much as possible by giving our rodents very specific experiences. So, for example, being put into an experimental box and being given a food reward to form a kind of positive memory. And then we take all of what we know and what we've learned in the last 100 years of neuroscience about how positive memories form in the brain, and that gives us different targets. There's different areas that are specialized in processing positive experiences or experiences themselves, and that gives us a bit of a hint as to where to begin looking for those cellular correlates of that experience.
Hmm. I want to mention one of the analogies that you write about, which is that you basically say when we have a memory, when we think about a memory, it's like hitting save as on a Microsoft Word document. It's not like an independent video or photo on your phone or something. You're constantly sort of writing and writing over and rewriting a memory. I guess, like, how fluid are our memories?
That's a great question. And it, honestly, I think it's pretty fluid to answer it scientifically. I mean, I think that there's this aphorism that you can't step in the same river twice. And I think that it's true about memory as well, that we can't recall the exact same memory twice. And it's because what we're doing at the time of recalling a memory biases how we recall that memory, and how we're feeling when we recall a memory also biases the contents of the memory that we're recalling.
Does that help explain why two or more people who experience the same event might remember it differently?
I think that's exactly what underpins that phenomenon. We hope that our collective experience gets a little bit closer to the truth of what actually happened in the past. But the reality is that we're all probably telling each other unknowingly a bit of a white lie about what actually happened in the past.
Huh. So I'm curious how you think about sort of the morals of adjusting people's memories. Obviously, you know, somebody who's gone through something very traumatic, it would make sense that maybe you want to sort of lessen that memory or adjust it some way. But I wonder, are there instances in which it's maybe not appropriate to do this kind of thing?
Without a doubt. This is it's a really important topic to consider here, because the way that this can be misused is pretty obvious, and we've had Hollywood kind of hit us over the head for the past decades of how memory manipulation can be misused. So we have a pretty good idea of all of the ways that this can be bad. And one thing that I really like emphasizing is that real life doesn't necessarily have to be like Hollywood or sci-fi, that we can think of all of the good that can be done with this if we're strategic about it and have an ethically bounded goal in sight. So, for example, memory manipulation sounds sinister, as it should. And I'd like to think that if we have the ethically bounded goal of changing memories for the sake of restoring health and well-being to an individual, then we have a goal. Now, suddenly, this can be part of the toolkit that we have to address psychiatric and neurodegenerative disorders. If we can keep memory alteration in a clinical and medical setting, then we can give it to the person that's suffering from a given psychiatric disorder or a given degenerative disorder, rather than having it be this kind of recreational thing that can be used and abused without really knowing what the side effects are, for that matter.
Right. Well, is it possible, do you think, to manipulate or adjust a memory, but still have sort of the lessons that it taught us, or, you know, keep the element of that memory that made somebody who they are or led them down a particular path? Like, can you sort of just take out part of it and not all of it?
Yes. And I love the way that you phrased it, because that is exactly what experimental neuroscience lets us do. One way I think about this is, anything that we've had in our past that caused us some kind of mental anguish, like let's say even a breakup in high school, like in the moment, right, it still feels like the end of the world.
Yeah.
And it still hurts and it's still heartbreak. But now I remember that I went through a breakup in high school, and I remember, I can describe how I felt, but I don't necessarily have to relive the really block components of that memory per se. I just know that it happened, it didn't feel great, and I move on with my life. And presumably I grow from it as well. And that's kind of what we hope would happen by being able to help an individual or an organism that's had a particularly traumatic experience, for that matter, is to still be able to use that experience and to learn from it, but without the components that might be pushing us more towards a disorder, with, of course, generalized anxiety and PTSD being probably the two most highly occurring examples.
Oh, that's so interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Steve, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was really a blast.
Steve Ramirez is an associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Boston University. He'll be speaking at the Mesa Art Center on April 8th as part of the National Geographic Live series at an event called Untangling the Mind.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Bassist Christian McBride plays the Mesa Arts Center on Thursday. He's performing with fellow bassist Edgar Meyer. Their show will blend jazz, classical, and bluegrass. It's a fitting mix for McBride, who's been at the forefront of jazz innovation since he broke onto the scene as a teenager. Once referred to as one of jazz's young lions, he's now an undisputed elder statesman of the genre, though at 53, he's still very much in his prime. McBride doesn't just shape the sound of modern jazz with his bass. He's also the host of the long-running public radio show Jazz Night in America on WBGO, and served for many years as the artistic director of the annual Newport Jazz Festival. He's toured and recorded with just about every famous name in jazz history, and my co-host Sam Dingman spoke with him recently about how he approaches his collaborations.
If I could, I wanted to actually start off on a personal note. To talk about what is truly one of my favorite songs, which is you and Joe Henderson playing Billy Strayhorn's song Isfahan on the 1992 album Lush Life. That track is just you on the bass and Joe on tenor sax. Can I ask you what, if anything, you remember about recording that particular song?
You know, we recorded that album in the fall of 91. So I was 19 at the time.
Wow.
I go back and listen to that now, and I feel like I sound like I'm 19. Like I, a lot of the stuff I played on that track, I mean, I would never play that now. And it's just like, oh, I wish I could have that back.
Really?
I know more now, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to invoke that memory for you. But
I'm sure most people, you know, would want to go back and redo things they did at age 19.
Of course. I know I would.
Yeah, right.
But I was thinking, you know, getting ready to talk to you today, that, you know, I've never really sat down and thought to myself, like, what is it that I love so much about this particular recording? And there are many things, but one of them is that the sound of you on the bass is such a big part of it. It's not a rhythm instrument in that song. It's like you and Joe making this harmony together. I guess it made me want to ask you, what was it that drew you originally to playing the bass, to the sound of the bass, and what was your relationship towards the idea of it having a distinct sound and not just being a rhythm instrument?
Well, if you're talking specifically leading up to the moment that I was 19, I mean, none of that was in my head at the time. I was much more of a pragmatic thinker. It was, you know, play what you need to play to make the band leader happy. You know?
Yeah.
It frustrates me sometimes when I hear young musicians kind of putting unneeded obstacles in their way. I'm not sure where this whole idea of finding your voice and kind of finding your individuality came from. Just simply play the gig. Somebody calls you for a gig, play what they ask you to play, period. You know, all that stuff about finding your voice and finding your individuality, you already have it, but you can't accept it until you've done until you've practiced your trade for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, I've never really had those thoughts about individuality or kind of thinking of the voice as a rhythm or a non-rhythm instrument. You know, I realize what my primary role is as a bass player. So as long as I'm doing that, I will always work, you know.
Right.
Right. And if I'm in a situation where the bass is sort of like a second melodic instrument, then I'll make it a second melodic instrument, you know. But only when the music tells you to do that.
That's very interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, it's not that you maybe thought in that moment like, this is my chance to step into the spotlight. It's more like,
oh, not at all.
The job is,
that's right,
play harmony.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So that makes me think of something else I heard you say once that I really love. You said your only goal was to, quote, play with as many bad cats as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what was important to you about that? Not just listening to these jazz players and absorbing their work, being influenced by it, but finding a way to actually play with them. What's the meaningful difference there for you?
I mean, you can't get better at anything unless you're around people who do what you want to do better than you, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. as a musician, I wasn't afraid to get embarrassed. My desire to get better was bigger than my pride.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a problem with some people. You know, they're afraid to fail. And trust me, I so understand that. But at some point, you have to figure out what's more important.
It feels like there's a real lesson in this that you're saying, where if you approach the opportunity to play with people like this, not as a chance to kind of strut your stuff, and more as a way of kind of challenging yourself,
getting better. That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And can I give this person what they need?
Yeah.
Not just make them exactly notice right. me.
Bass players are like, you know, EMT workers. You know, we're the engine room.
Uh-huh. Well, so what has that looked like for you in your own playing? Like, I think of the 5-piece band with John McLaughlin mm-hmm. and Chick Corea. I think of the Philadelphia Experiment with Questlove. I realize those records are still, broadly speaking, within the jazz idiom in terms of fusion, but there's a lot of like prog rock and funk influences in there. When you come back to spaces where you are playing more straight-ahead jazz, what do you feel like you bring back with you from those contexts where you're playing less traditional forms of jazz? Do you feel like it informs your quote unquote more straight ahead playing?
Probably not.
really? Okay.
I'm not going to go play a gig with Chick Corea's trio and then say, let me figure out a way to put this in there. No, right. Uh-huh. I'm not going to do that.
Right.
Again, that comes from that play the gig mentality that mm-hmm. I have, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I don't really try to bring anything from anywhere unless I think it fits.
That's really fascinating, I have to say, Christian. I mean, this, it seems like there's this recurring theme in a lot of what you've been saying that I really admire, where even though you are undoubtedly a legend of this music, the subtext of a lot of what you're saying is it's not about me. You said once that a great artist, quote, has one foot in the future, one foot in the past, and their body in the present. So where does your future foot want jazz to walk towards?
I think the biggest thing that makes me raise an eyebrow is that while we now respect jazz and what it does on a musical level, it's important to also study the culture which breeds it. I've always made this joke, which isn't actually really a joke, that back when they had the Thelonious Monk International competition, I thought if Thelonious Monk were alive and sent in an audition tape for his own competition, he probably wouldn't even make the semifinals.
Huh.
Did Charles Mingus have the chops to be able to play what would be demanded of a lot of these competitions now? They say, oh, well, you know, the worship part of jazz says, oh, yeah, Mingus could do anything. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Coltrane could have done anything. Well, no, it's like if you want to really, really, really embrace jazz, you need to embrace the culture from which it comes from. And that means a culture of a people of lesser means. The struggle and the grit, the lack of reference that a lot of those musicians had from the 40s and 50s. Like, see, musicians now, we sit up here and we judge who was doing what and what this person was doing and blah, 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 blah. You know, we get to go back and study all of these records, and part of our judgment of younger musicians is how many records have they studied. Monk didn't have to do that. Dizzy didn't have to do that. Bird didn't have to do that. Horace Silver didn't have to do that. I just want to make sure that we don't sanitize the history of the music too much, you know.
So let me make sure I understand this. You're saying that guys like Monk and Silver, they didn't have the means that people now have, that some people now have, to
correct,
go to a fancy, you know, jazz
university
right, and study with really, pay all this money to study with really famous teachers and
that's
buy
right,
all the records. And
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there can be a way that there's a part of jazz curriculum where you leave your students actually in the dark. Like, you kind of have to almost make them find their own way. Like, okay, like, you have the teacher in the room, you say, you look at the student and say, okay, what are you going to play? Let's play Bolivia.
Uh-huh.
One student says, well, I don't know it. Great, play it anyway, right? And you make them learn it on the spot, right?
Yeah.
And then...
talk about not being afraid to make mistakes.
Right, right. There's a part of this music that you got to fend for yourself.
Christian McBride will be at the Mesa Arts Center on Thursday night. Christian, thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. If you've ever traveled to the far southern reaches of our fair state, near Patagonia on the Mexico border, you know you'll find a region that looks different than the dry, rocky, saguaro-laden desert we live in here in the valley. There are grassy fields, tree-covered mountains, desert scrub, riparian preserves. In fact, it's one of the top biodiversity hotspots in the world, especially for birders.
On our preserve, on the Patagonia Sonoyta Creek Preserve, we have over 270 different bird species that have been documented here.
Wow.
And part of the reason for that is we sit right in the middle of a number of flyways for migrating birds.
That's Aaron Morotek, Patagonia Sonoyta Creek Preserve Manager for the Nature Conservancy. He told me the region turns out to be pretty perfect for birds on their migrations, north for the summer, south for the winter. Think of it as a sort of rest stop for them along the way. But those all-important rest stops are in danger now as climate change threatens these delicate ecosystems. I spoke with him more about it, beginning with why this region is so perfect for migrating birds.
We sit in an area called the Madrean Sky Island ecosystem through here.
Ah.
So we're sitting like in this kind of Sonoran Desert ecoregion, but within that ecoregion, we have all of these mountain ranges that pop up. And of course, that's giving you different elevation gradients that give rise to different habitat types. So because of the very differentiated habitat types that we have through here, it allows for various bird species that rely on those very specific habitat types to all find their individual ecological niches.
Wow.
To be able to thrive and move through this area and continue on in their life cycles.
That's amazing. So this kind of idea of a stopover, like a rest stop for birds as they're migrating and the reasons they're drawn, these are really important for birds and for those migration patterns, right? Like if they don't have those rest stops, it can be a problem.
Absolutely. That's spot on. You know, in particular in this area that we sit in, we're at about 4,000 feet of elevation here in Patagonia. And so we are right in the middle of that transition zone between kind of that lower Sonoran Desert ecoregion, which is generally characterized by, you know, our iconic saguaro cacti. But then we're like up above us in these mountain ranges, we have Douglas fir forest, ponderosa pines, mixed oak woodland chaparral zones.
Yeah.
But I think one of the really big distinguishing features about our area is that we have a perennial stream that runs right through the middle of it, and that's Sonoyta Creek. Mm. So Sonoyta Creek runs approximately 12 miles, and there's surface water throughout that entire 12 miles there. And, you know, in the desert, water is life. It's not just life for people. It's also life for birds and mammals and reptiles. And so really that surface water availability really creates a profoundly important habitat through here for those animals that are migrating to be able to access that water for their stopovers.
Okay, so tell us some of the species that come through. I know you're not like an extreme birder here, but that you enjoy or that folks are really there for. Are there really outstanding highlights that people come to see every year?
Yeah, well, while I'm not an extreme birder, I do associate and I'm around extreme birders all of the time. So I can fortunately name a couple for you here.
Okay.
You know, there's a number of different warbler species that are really iconic in this area for migrating species coming through here. For instance, Lucy's warblers, those just showed up here on the preserve, and they really tend to enjoy our mesquite bosque habitat type through this preserve through here. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite birds that migrates here every summer is the greyhawk. Okay.
Whoa.
And greyhawks have greyhawks have very specific habitat requirements. They really like riparian zones with field habitats adjacent to those riparian zones. And that really characterizes the Patagonia Sonoyta Creek Preserve, which I'm sitting at here right now. We have that riparian ecosystem moving through here with these big grassland fields that surround it. So it's really the perfect habitat type for these greyhawks. And greyhawks, you know, they're more commonly found through much of Sonora, Mexico, and down south of that as well, but their northernmost range is right around here in southern Arizona. And so as a migrating species, to be able to see that species that you would most commonly see in Mexico coming up into the United States, I think that really makes it super, super unique. And people, again, travel from all over the world to come to this area of the world to be able to view that greyhawk, to enjoy it in its natural habitat.
Yeah, that's amazing. Greyhawk. So, I mean, these kind of rest stops, these stopovers for these migratory birds, though, are becoming harder to find, it sounds like, especially when it comes to those incredibly specific ones they can be, like for the greyhawk you mentioned. I mean, what happens when one of these rest stops disappears? Are we seeing this happen in southern Arizona?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in southern Arizona, we're seeing a long-term trend of drier winters and reduced monsoonal precipitation. And we're also combining that with increased water consumption in the state of Arizona by a growing human population. And that's causing many of our once perennial streams to start to run dry, resulting in the loss of not only the valuable aquatic habitat, but maybe more importantly for a lot of these migrating birds, the associated riparian habitat that would be found alongside of these stream ecosystems.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned, water in the desert is life, but it is also our greatest limiting resources. Mm. And climate models suggest that Arizona may continue to see reduced precipitation annually throughout our entire state. And so we're seeing that reduced precipitation. We're seeing warmer daytime and nighttime temperatures, which are stressing these natural ecosystems and creating optimal conditions for things like wildfires or pest insects or diseases or invasive species to come into these areas that were once really, really important stopovers and still continue to be. But we're seeing those stresses start to result in ecosystem conversion, where vegetative communities are slowly being replaced by species that are suited to a warmer and drier climate. Mm. And ultimately, these conversions can result in habitat shifts, leading to the replacement of entire wildlife communities, which is really concerning for the long-term sustainability of these migration stopovers throughout the entire state of Arizona.
Yeah. So let me ask you lastly, Aaron, like the question, I guess, that drives this home for folks, because I know we talk a lot about water scarcity. We talk a lot about climate change and warming weather. And I think a lot of folks will say, you know, we can't worry about things like migratory birds when we have to worry about, you know, human beings having these kind of resources going forward. But there are, when it comes to these species, broader ecological questions at hand, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think I tend not to be focused on single species. I tend to think of our ecosystems as really, really complex processes. Really, what we're starting to see is an upset in the balance of these really, really complex systems that we call ecosystems down here. And fortunately, there are a number of solutions.
Okay,
some of those solutions might look like conserving a variety of habitats. We're looking at restoring and maintaining those diverse habitats to support broad species assemblages. And really, what we also seek to do is implement long-term monitoring protocols for vulnerable species, in particular migrating vulnerable species and their associated habitats, to inform adaptive management. So these are some of the things that we can think about doing to preserve these really, really important flyovers or stopovers for migrating species across our entire state of Arizona.
Okay. Well, glad it's not hopeless, it sounds like. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Aaron Morotek, Patagonia Sonoida Creek Preserve Manager for the Nature Conservancy, joining us to talk about stopovers for migratory birds. Aaron, thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much.
All right, that's it for today's edition of the show. We will join you again tomorrow morning with much more, of course, as always. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.